Post Harlan Mono Logics. Number 00071. Recorded on March 6, 2024. Production location, Post Harlan, Texas. Draxicology, Part 2, Chapter 71.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88. This monologue is continued from the previous episode, Chapter 00070, Draxicology, Part 1.
And so there is, quite evidently, a direct line drawn between the dropout pop culture and overall United States of America cultural decline. We look back historically, we look back sociologically to the 1960s as the great expression of the counterculture making its great impact. But all of that evolved out of its predecessors, just like anything else in life, right? And we could take it back, really. You could take it back, as I expressed in the prior episode, to the onset of the central banking system in the 1910s, and also the first seeds of communism in this country being planted around 1920 with the longshoremen unions in San Francisco and the intrusion into the universities in San Francisco and in New York City. These became the bastions of communism in this country, and to this day, they represent the furthest far left extremities of our society. The original cancer on our American pop culture was what we know today as the beatniks, right? The beatniks. Now let me explain how this all happens, and I'll get to exactly who they are. All right? American pop music in the 1950s centered predominantly around Memphis, Nashville, and I guess you were starting to get the trace beginnings of the Motown scene in Detroit, right? As well as other places, right? Now, let me give a little bit of detail on what I mean to say by this. When I talk about Memphis as being kind of like a central location for pop music of the 50s, we're talking about the lines of the blues and the lines of rockabilly and the lines of rock and roll, right? That all originates in Memphis. However, the blues, for example, had also reached up and had its variants, its more urban variants up in Chicago and St. Louis, right? They had their musical scenes with the blues there. You had St. Louis blues, you had the Chicago-style blues, but you also had the Memphis blues that came up out of the Mississippi Delta, right? So there was more than just Memphis, but Memphis was the actual core, right? It started in Memphis before it migrated up north, is what I'm trying to say, right? Nashville, of course, is the country scene, and that, of course, will incorporate what was going on in Knoxville, Tennessee, right? Tennessee, you've got... You look at the state of Tennessee's flag, right? Their state flag, it's got three stars on it. I used to live in Tennessee. I know this stuff. The three stars represent the three regions of Tennessee. You got the East, you got the Central, and you got the West, right? Now, the West, the Western star is represented by the city of Memphis. The Central star is represented by the city of Nashville. And the Eastern Star is represented by the city of Knoxville, right? As Memphis, like I said before, is the Delta Blues, the Rockabilly, Rock and Roll. That's that music all came together and emanated from there, right? That's the cultural, the original cultural center of those three types of music. And Knoxville, all the way on the other side of the state, was the bluegrass capital of the earth, right? In between that, you had country music, which is the Nashville scene, which Nashville is made up of, you could call it a combination of everything that was going on in Memphis and everything that was going on in Knoxville, right? Country music is an amalgamation of bluegrass, blues, rockabilly, rock and roll. They all come together, right? In fact, of those 5 different styles of Americana roots music, country music is the most ambiguous of them all. But nonetheless, it is clearly its own element at the same time. It's very peculiar like that, right? But anyway, so you got what was going on in Tennessee. Let's just make it plain and simple. Plus, what happened in the same regard that Chicago and St. Louis established their own blues scenes, Detroit was beginning into its own variation of the blues, which was called R&B, rhythm and blues, right? Which exists to this day. And it also brought in some soul, so did country music, right? The bluegrass, they all had some kind of soul music. That Christian element to it, right? The themes of this music was generally young love, hard work, the places, the backdrops where it took, like Happy Days with Fonzie and Potsy and Richie and Ralph Mouth. You had the malt shops, country music with their honky tonks, the blues clubs of Memphis and of Chicago. And of St. Louis, you had the juke joints down in the Delta, right? These were the places where nightlife happened. And, you know, music has this tendency to be what I call incestuous, right? It sings about itself. Singers sing about their life, their travels, their travails, their trials. You end up having songs about the music industry, songs about songs. Think of Lynyrd Skynyrd, like working for MCA, right? I can't relate to that because I'm not a musician. That's not my problem, right? With a reach, I can make it happen. Sometimes your job sucks like mine does now. But I don't want to get off on that tangent, right? It's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about what the content of the Tennessee-based music, the Americana roots music, as it was in the 50s, right? Like I said, it was about young love and hard work. Maybe the trials and tribulations involved with both young love and hard work. The backdrop were malt shops and honky tonks and blues clubs and juke joints, right? But the singers, right? The musicians of the time, they were a different beast compared to what would happen in and after the 60s, right? These guys were World War II veterans and Korea War veterans. And if they didn't actually fight like overseas wars, they were still soldiers. They enlisted or were drafted. Think of Elvis, for example. Elvis had an album called G.I. Blues. He volunteered. Elvis Presley, the king of rock and roll, in the 50s, volunteered for the Army. The biggest star on earth volunteered for the Army. 10 years later, everything was about avoiding the war, avoiding the draft, anti-establishment, anti-government, right? And Elvis and his ilk were kind of left in the dust as old-timey squares, right? So you have this line of delineation occurring between what was going on in the 50s and what happened in the 60s, right? And the musicians of the 50s were different breeds. They were veterans. They were heterosexual. The American roots music of the day, it was not queer. It was not shiftless. It was not about or attached to this ideology of quote-unquote dropping out, right? Dropping out of society. That's the line. That's the line that delineates the American roots music from this corrupt, I want to call it garbage, but that's only a matter of the intent of it all. The music was very good in the 60s. The bands from England and everything, who I'm about to really gripe about and piss on, right? They were very good. They were very talented. Their music is a backdrop of my life because my life involved dropping out. So I know what I'm talking about, right? But that was the line. It was the willingness to walk into this life, to deal with life on life's terms, to grasp reality and exist in it versus dropping out and letting your imagination go and being led by your base desires. Let's just put it plain, right? Let's just put it plain for what it is. That's what it always adds up to be. And I'll show you how that comes about being, right? Again, what I'm talking about now is the cancer on pop culture in the United States that was born out of this movement called the Beatniks, right? And I'll get into exactly who the Beatniks are, or were, but I can tell you this about them. They did not have their own musical expression, right? They adopted jazz as kind of like this free-form, improvisational background music to their poetry and prose readings that they would do in the coffee shops. These are these people, the coffee house people of the 50s and the early 60s, you know, with the little Lenin goatees and the French berets, and, you know, reading poetry. I honestly never got with that, right? It's very much related to university life, right? This is off-campus nightlife that was out there waiting to corrupt the minds of susceptible students. And I'll get into that, too, as we go, okay? The idea about this infection being oriented towards students, quote-unquote students. These beatniks, they didn't have no actual pop music contribution. They co-opted a free form of jazz as part of their cultural ambiance. They were, simply stated, dropout literary fags. They were, in the origins, writers, right? I talked about the poetry and the prose, right? That would be their actual vocal expression of their art. But they were writers. In the beginning, they were a group of writers that hung out together, right? And did I say fags? Did I say fags? Why did I say fags? Because they're fags. I think like out of the four primary originators of this, quote, beat movement, the beatniks, two of them were gay, one of them was bisexual, and one of them was heterosexual. And I'll get into like the backgrounds of these people, I'll name them by name and everything like that. But yeah, when I said fags, I meant fags, all right? Dropout literary fags. This dropout ethic was the early stages of the malignant cells of our cultural decline in this country. That's what I track it back to. But you could track that back to the onset of communism, which was the result of the onset of the central banking system. Believe me, that whole central bank, Federal Reserve thing was the loss of our nation to Britain and the Zionists in the ongoing Revolutionary War. The ongoing effort of Britain to get something out of the Americas. That's heavy. That's heavy. I hope that kind of talk raises the American citizen inside of you and makes you think a little differently about what the hell is going on. But let me move on from that and maybe pick it up later, right? So you had this thing happening, the beatniks, right? So they were the dropout culture. That was the origins of this quote-unquote dropout culture, or what we know as counterculture. And think about that. Counterculture. It's culture opposed to the existing culture. So we had an American society, and post-war America, late 40s and through the 50s, that was a golden era of this country. The artistic expression, the architectural expression, everything was just through the roof, right? Just through the roof. They seem to be the happiest of times, with the exception of some of the racist bullshit that was going on down here in the South. And right, and as a Southerner, as a Texan, as a Southwesterner, I could say it was bullshit. Jim Crow laws, the sunset or sundowning or whatever the hell they call it, still that exists in Mississippi in some counties, that is horseshit. I'm not a racially oriented person. I am not a racist. I have differences. I don't really feel the need to express myself. I like culture, and I see cultural differences. And the differences between you and me, they're not about color of skin. They're about background. They're about culture. I'm not the only person that recognizes this as a fact of being, right? It is racists that drive racism. Race pimps that make money off of it. That's a whole nother thing. Again, another avenue I'm not prepared to go down at the moment because that's not part of the itinerary here, right? So you had this existence of the beatniks, which began. The dropout counterculture began in the United States post-war 40s, right? At the very same time the golden era of this country was starting to shine, you had the detractors. The cancer, the cultural cancer, was beginning. And they were beginning in association with the universities, particular, and we'll go back to ground zero of communism in New York City. Outside of Columbia University, Greenwich Village, Washington Square Park, right? Where the folk music scene would soon thereafter emerge. Not as the music of the beatniks, but having a relation to the beatniks with the arm of communism, right? The beatniks were part communist in their constitution. And folk music, which was the music of the working man in this country, was co-opted by communists because they were infiltrating society in part through the labor unions, right? You see how all this shit is connected. So here in Greenwich Village, outside of Columbia University, you had both a communist folk music scene that had the likes of Bob Dylan, some of the members of the Mamas and Papas, and others, right? There, that was that folk music scene in New York, in Greenwich Village, with the commies, the politics, the homosexuals, all that stuff. And you also had these four counterculture literary icons that hung out around there, right? So it all came together. The beatniks kind of merged with folk music, the folk music did not come out of the beatniks. It did not come out of the beat generation, but it had a hand-in-hand relationship in the late 50s and early 60s. Folk music would in turn morph. But before I get to that, at the same time in the late 50s and late 60s, over across the seas, over across the pond, in Great Britain, London, and Liverpool, you had a British version of pop music happening that was based on what was going on in Memphis, Tennessee. They were taking up over there with the blues, and they were taking up over there with rockabilly. They were taking up over there with rock and roll, right? I use the Rolling Stones and the Beatles as kind of like the two emblematic representation of the original British invasion styles of music to come over, right? Rolling Stones were heavily blues-oriented. Their roots were covering blues music, right? And that's what they were about, and it gave them the edge that they had. They were different than the Beatles. The Beatles, though they would probably hack around with the blues, they were really interested more in what was going on with the Everly Brothers. Did you know that? All the Beatles are is an attempt to copy the Everlys, the Everly Brothers, right? Everly Brothers, their music was beautiful. It was beautiful, right? But that's what the Beatles were trying to emulate. And when the Beatles were fixing to do that, they were being emulated by other British bands. And that's where you get that Mercy Beat, right? So you had the Mercy Beat, and you kind of had the Brit Blues going on. The Brit Blues, the Rolling Stones, The Who kind of sort of not exactly. They took the blues and they did something with it. They were mods and they were kind of in a different style. They were the Maximum Rhythm and Blues, as they called themselves. I shit you not, the Scooby-Doo Mystery Machine van is pulling in the parking lot and driving by me right now. Holy crap. Look at that. Anyway, way off topic, but hey, truth happens at its pace in its time, right? This is what was going on with Britain anyway, right? So you had kind of had like that blues arm, and you had that kind of Everly Brothers arm, represented by the Rolling Stones on the one hand and by the Beatles on the other hand, right? And you know, more I was talking about blues bands of Britain in the 60s, right? I started off with a very uncertain example in The Who, but more certain would be Eric Clapton, Cream, right? More certain would be, if you want to call Jimi Hendrix Experience a Brit band, that was a both. That was American on the one hand, then it was British on the other, right? The trio, Jimi Hendrix Experience, that was blues music. Pink Floyd was blues music from the beginning. Believe it or not, Yes, right? They started out as a blues band. I don't believe they recorded as one. They quickly really evolved into and kind of established, created that prog rock, progressive rock. And part of that was Jethro Tull, right? Led Zeppelin, of course, the Yardbirds, all blues. These were all these blues bands. So they were kind of all in the lines of like the Rolling Stones. And then you had the Mercy Beat stuff that was in the lines of the Beatles, like the Dave Clark Five, for one example. I guess Herman Hermits and whatever, right? Whatever. That music, like I said, was on the lines of emulating what the Everly Brothers had started here in America. But it also maintained a lot of the hokey, ridiculous British stuff, like British weird humorous. Yeah, it's just tomfoolery to me. It's junk. Beatles are loaded with it in their songs throughout their history. Pink Floyd, their Sid Barrett years, has a bunch of that kind of crap in it. And the Brits bring a certain sense of humor to their music at times, and that was not lost in their attempts to emulate American music, right? Honestly, I think the Rolling Stones were above that sort of thing. For the most part, you know, I bring up the Dandelion song. That was kind of, well, no, that was psychedelic. That was straight up. That was, never mind. Moving on from that, right? So you got this scene in this pop music scene going on in Great Britain that was based on emulating what was going on in America. You had two very distinct arms of it represented by the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, one being the blues, one being the Everly Brothers, those type of music, right? Everly Brothers was soft rock and roll, right? Very, very harmonic, melodic, soft rock and roll music. And that's the kind of rock and roll that Britain sent to us, right? They heard ours and they sent it back that way. The blues with the Rolling Stones and all those other bands I named, they took the blues that they heard from us and they sent it back their way. Their music was good. It was good, right? I'm not saying that the music sucked. I'm saying that all of that, the one thing that they did not emulate with the blues guys and with the Everly Brothers, they did not emulate the actuality of life. What I mean to say is they fell in with the dropouts. They were counterculture. So when you hear the term British invasion related to the pop music of the 60s, it certainly was an invasion. That was a massive push of counterculture music into the American psyche. And I believe there was intent behind it. Are you following me? Are you following me? I mentioned about American folk music having had been co-opted by the communists in San Francisco and New York, and how it became associated with the beatniks as an arm of the dropout culture. And again, these British invasion bands were also dropout culture. So that line of delineation, you know, it separates Elvis from the Mamas and the Papas. It separates Buddy Holly from the Beatles. Right? That line is counterculture, the dropout line. The cancer on society, right? So, while Americana pop was Memphis, Nashville, Detroit, it was heterosexual veteran music about romance, work, patriotism, right? These guys sang ballads and things like that. They had soul music, which was singing to their faith, right? And then, of course, their nightlife, like I mentioned, all the different, you know, honky-tonks and the juke joints and et cetera, so forth, right? You had, on the other hand, that folk mercy beat, British blues, folk rock, and psychedelic rock, which all evolved out of these themes, thematically speaking. Lyrically speaking, these things were in line with dropping out, with experimenting with the bohemian, there's a word for you, bohemian counterculture activities, such as narcotics and free love, homosexuality, political rebellion, communism, occultism, and as such. You see where I'm going? All these abominable aspects of our being, right, seem to all be incorporated thematically in the music of these counterculture bands of the 60s. So when you had these old timers with the horn rim glasses talking about the devil's music, right? When you had the old timey Delta black preachers in the churches on Sunday mornings in Mississippi, Louisiana, and Arkansas talking about the devil's music, right? The blues being the devil's music. And Robert Johnson, music of the devil. This is why. This is why. There is a certain moral bearing that existed prior to this inception of the counterculture in this country, which was fostered here domestically through the communists and universities and imported from Britain additional counterculture musical outlets to drive who? The students into what? Damnation. On one side, you had the likes of Elvis Presley, the Everly Brothers, Johnny Cash, Muddy Waters, Carl Perkins, Chet Atkins, Chuck Berry, Buddy Holly, Roy Orbison, B.B. King, Marty Robbins, the list goes on. Then on the other side, you had, as I said, the Stones, the Beatles, the Mamas and the Papas, the Byrds, Jimi Hendrix Experience, Bob Dylan, Jefferson Airplane, Arlo Guthrie, the Grateful Dead, the Doors, Janis Joplin, right? The marketing of all this bohemian dropout culture shit eventually, as you know, as history dictates, won the day. What would become of quote-unquote rock music was not a the direct continuity of what Elvis Presley and Buddy Holly were doing. It became completely bastardized and twisted off into multiple dimensions of perversion and immorality. The power behind it all, right, was the powers that were behind what? Los Angeles. I haven't even mentioned that hardly, right? But I mentioned some of the bands that spawned up out of there in the psychedelic era. These folk rock bands that went psychedelic. Mamas and the Papas, the Byrds, for two quick examples off the top of the head, right? In the Laurel Canyon scene. The Laurel Canyon scene. Look up Dave McGowan. See if you could find something online about Dave McGowan. The guy's got books on it. Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon, it's called, right? It tells a story of how all these counterculture artists, especially musicians, in some cases you can hardly call them that, all kind of settled in LA at the same time from all different points of the world and became what we know as hippies, right? The actual hippie culture began in Los Angeles before it was even in San Francisco. The commies were in San Francisco already. The hippies started down in LA, and it happened like that. So Los Angeles was definitely a big part of this whole counterculture scene, and it was greater than just music. The entire pop culture really comes out of Los Angeles. In my entire lifetime, I was born in 1967, it's always been the case. It happens first in LA, and then it gets replicated in certain parts of the country, and then it spreads like cancer, right? This is the death of our pop culture, what we had in the golden era in the in the 50s, right, being stripped of us cell by cell as we go through time, right? The power behind Los Angeles was the power behind the movies, TV, right, Hollywood, and also porn, right? All that kind of money, all that kind of exposure, right? And in New York City, on the other hand, you got the what do they call it, Fifth Avenue, Madison Avenue. Madison Avenue, New York City, right? The advertising. And then you got the fashion out of New York also. So you get fashion in New York, you get fashion advertising in New York, you get the movies, TV, and pornography out of LA, right? And all the money involved with all that, and all the accessibility given to the counterculture in the 60s and all time following, had that counterculture co-opting of Americana music win the day and leave the likes of Elvis and Buddy Holly in the dust as old, useless squares. Interesting, right? They won the day. And, you know, believe it or not, part of the powers behind this push supporting the counterculture in the 60s was also the military-industrial complex, the politics involved with that, right? Military-industrial complex, what is their interest? Defense spending, perpetual war, economy generating money. And now, take a step back and look at that. Who's interested in that? Well, as a citizen of the United States of America, I would be generally interested in a strong, capable military. For what? The defense of the nation, right? I'm not interested in aggressing the world and colonizing. Yet this country finds itself in the past 100 years doing that sort of shit. How does that happen? Because I told you before, we got took over with the Federal Reserve System by Brits and their Zionist compatriots, or compadres, whatever the hell you want to call them, colleagues, kin. And now we're doing what they've always done. You've got two cultures of people coming out of Britain who are known for colonizing. They do it in different ways, but they both do it, and that's what they do. Americans are not colonizers, but here we are, colonizing in the way that we do it. But it's being driven by the powers behind the money, the banks. It all goes back to that. The military-industrial complex is not exclusively for the defense of the United States. It's not. It's an economic generator which transfers the wealth of the country back to Britain, because that's what they're doing. They couldn't win the Revolutionary War. They couldn't win the War 1812. They lost the Civil War. I still haven't gotten into that one yet, but believe me, they're part of the Civil War, and they were defeated there too. In between all that, they were trying to establish central banks. After that, they tried to establish central banks. It kept on failing. It kept on getting shot down. They kept on assassinating presidents that were working against them. Then finally, they got the Federal Reserve through, and they co-opted this nation. And from that point on, they've been siphoning money out of here. They've been destroying the culture of this place. And they've been using our military power to defend Britain and Israel. How did Britain suddenly become our best friend? Why do we, quote-unquote, stand with Israel like we do so strongly? What the hell did they ever do for us? How important are they? You got to step back and think about it, right? So the military-industrial complex, and this is part of what this Dave McGowan talks about in his Weird Scenes Inside the Canyon series, right? The military-industrial complex, in conjunction with the CIA, Central Intelligence, they co-opted a legitimate anti-war movement of the early 60s, right? Remember, John F. Kennedy, before he got assassinated, didn't want to be involved in Vietnam. Military-industrial complex and powers related to that had him killed so that they could go pursue their interests. Lyndon B. Johnson stepped in. Mind you, a Democrat, right? Progressive, all that. But he was all for the war in Vietnam. He was a part of that structure, the military defense spending, the perpetual war. And from that point forward, this is what we have in politics. Left wing, right wing, same damn bird, right? Win a legitimate anti-war effort. When I say legitimate, I mean you had young people fighting age in colleges, standing up, protesting the war in Vietnam before there was such a thing as a hippie. These were just college students that put two and two together and decided that this was bullshit, right? This didn't add up. It didn't make sense. That was the legitimate part. It was gaining steam as the years started going by. And what Dave McGowan says, and I think he's right, rest his soul in peace, he's dead now. Those military-industrial complex powers, Central Intelligence and everything involved, co-opted that anti-war movement, and they created this hippie thing. They made the hippies so outlandish, so bright, so clownish, so distasteful to the ordinary American Joe, right? Just so damn peculiar. And then they associated that ugliness with anti-war sentiment. So you created that rift, and you completely stole the legitimacy of anti-war protests and turned it into a circus, a clown show, that people who weren't on drugs, people who weren't part of the counterculture, didn't want anything to do with. They didn't want to be associated with that shit, right? That's how it flies. The way of the world. I just got a drive-by catcall from some faggot. He says he likes my style. Imagine that. Driving by. Somebody's just driving by. You're walking along doing your thing. somebody rolls down their window and hollers out at you, "Hey, I like your style." "He likes my style." "My father would be so proud, you know. And my father, who claimed to have slept with 4,000 women. I'll bet he was never awarded style points from a fancy lad." Imagine. "I guess I'm queer bait now. You know, it's usually the black girls that go for my old cowboy swagger. But, you know." Anyway, all right, where the hell was I? Anyway, on to bigger and better things, right? Anyway, the origins of our bohemian counterculture, right? Bohemian counterculture. Let me define counterculture. I keep throwing that phrase out. I'll give you a dictionary definition. A culture, go figure, right? Especially of young people with values or lifestyles in opposition to those of the established culture, right? I don't know what the young people have to do with it in particularly. It's just a culture with values or lifestyles in opposition to those of the established culture, right? Counterculture. And I guess why I got the old dictionary out. This, by the way, is not the official Maverick 88 dictionary. This is American Heritage Dictionary online through an app, right? That's what I use when I'm looking up shit like this. Bohemian. A person with artistic or literary interests who disregards conventional standards of behavior. So, you know, bohemian, counterculture, they're kind of one and the same. Very subtle variants to it, you know. It's almost a redundancy to say, quote-unquote, bohemian counterculture. But bohemian is directed more toward an individual, where the counterculture is a group thing, right? So we can look at it like that. Bohemian now becomes an adjective. It's a counterculture who is loaded with artsy fartsies and literary, what did I say before? Literary faggots, right? Literary faggots who disregard conventional standards of behavior. So they behave unconventionally. And, that's all relative. That's all relative. In the 1950s, unconventional behavior was everything that they're trying to make the new norm now, right? The new normal. So that which is now unconventionable, that could be a Maverick 88 dictionary word. I'm going to have to contemplate that. But anyway, unconventional now would be, well, me. I'm unconventional. I'm not down with this whole immoral, perverse, pedophilia, occult, sex magic, faggotry thing that's being imposed upon us, right? And I'm sure it's shit not down with the whole New World Order / globalist, elitist, utopian ideologies. But anyway, bohemian counterculture, all right? So you got some dictionary learning given freely and graciously to you on this day. Consider yourself educated, right? Educated. Or as Popeye would say, edumacated. Right? Popeye the sailor man. Right? So I told you I was going to tell you about the beatniks, right? Beatniks being the original malignant cells of the cancer of pop culture in the United States. I had mentioned that it sprung up in the 40s, the post-World War II 40s, late 40s, became a thing, right? It became a thing. And off the top of my head, it was a thing that started with Jack Kerouac. And I'm not even sure if that's exactly how you pronounce that name. It's a name I'm familiar with. I read the stuff, right? I'm going to go over four literary guys that set up the core of this beatnik movement, this social phenomena, this counterculture, right? But the first of them was this Jack Kerouac, who was, if I recall, of French-Canadian origin, not especially high class. In fact, I think, if I remember right, he was the son of a potato farmer or something like that, right? Ended up coming into the States through New England and being settled in New York City, right? So he becomes kind of ground zero of this counterculture movement. He was, of the four, probably the closest thing to a man's man, right? I think he was in the Navy. I think he got out of the Navy on some kind of psychiatrical issue. He was called like something relative to schizoid, right? So he had mental health issues, but he was also like a merchant marine, if I remember right. But he was also a writer. I believe he got some kind of education or edumacation, as the case may be. But he lived out of his mother's house in Queens, New York, but he hung around over in Greenwich Village in the artsy-fartsy community, right? And he's basically the original beatnik, and in his hanging around, he attracted these other three. Who were they? William S. Burroughs for one, Neil Cassady for another, and Allen Ginsberg for the last, right? But let me get you a little Wikipedia snippet of, well, I thought I had it here. Beatnik. Bear with me, please, for a moment, just so I can give you like a visual of what these people looked like and how they operated on a daily basis. Beatnik, according to Wikipedia, all right, beatniks were members of a social movement in the mid-20th century. That's the 1900s for you and I, right? Who subscribed to an anti-materialistic lifestyle. They rejected the conformity and consumerism of mainstream American culture and expressed themselves through various forms of art, such as literature, poetry, music, and painting. They also experimented with spirituality, drugs, sexuality, and travel. Experiment with travel. Okay. The term beatnik was coined by a San Francisco... There's your San Francisco, right? Coined by San Francisco Chronicle columnist Herb Caen in 1958 as a derogatory label for the followers of the Beat Generation, a group of influential writers and artists who emerged during the era of the Silent Generation's maturing from as early as 1946 to as late as 1963. But the subculture was at its most prevalent in the 1950s. The name was inspired by the Russian suffix nik, which was used to denote members of various political or social groups, right? Now, let me pause there for a second, right? That's not even what I wanted to read about it. I just kind of took it from the top. Nick, right? You got the Beat Generation. Beat. I've not been able to see anybody express amongst these people in this beatnik realm what exactly that term beat means, right? I've seen attempts at it, but it's really... Yeah, as it was back in those days, young people with the drugs and everything like that, they don't know what the hell they're talking about half the time, right? These words come out of somewhere and it sticks somehow and it's like spaghetti on the wall, right? The suffix part, the nick, is what interests me, right? You got the beat, nick. Why, of all suffixes, would you choose nick? So, you know, when I see nick with my Slavic background, right, my Ukrainian background, I recognize nick as... a Soviet type, you know, this would mean Russian, Belarusian, Ukrainian, Eastern European suffix on a name, right? So it is, let's just call it Russian, right? Let's just call it Russian. A Russian word suffix, but in my experience, it's usually attached to a Jew. Right? It would be a Russian Jew, a Soviet Jew. Soviet's really the proper word for it, because not only does Nick have this Russian sense. Not only does it have this Jewish sense, but it also has a very Soviet sense, right? Think of things like Sputnik, right? The space shot, whatever the hell that was, right? When I see that suffix, I think of a Soviet Jew. And of course, that is almost a redundancy in itself, if you understand the history of the Soviets, right? The Bolsheviks. Soviet Jew, a redundancy. But anyway, yeah. So, like, you get this flavor now. You get these dropouts, right? And they give their grandiose reasoning as materialism this. Really, that's just an excuse that they don't want to be a part of what everybody's doing. They want to recede into the shadows. And I'm speaking from experience. I did this in my own life, right? You make up some kind of grandiose excuse why the world sucks. You back away from the world, and you do what you want to do. And what do you want to do? Drugs, sex, right? It's always the same with this shit. So anyway, where was I? Russian suffix, Nick. All right, the term beat originally was used by Jack Kerouac in 1948 to describe his social circle, right, of friends and fellow writers, such as Allen Ginsberg, as I said, William S. Burroughs, and Neil Cassidy. Here's what Kerouac had to say about that word beat, right? Kerouac said that beat had multiple meanings, right? There's the ambiguity of it all, and really just the no idea really what the hell it means of it all. Had multiple meanings of beaten down, beatific, beat up, beat out. I would say probably beat off. He also associated with the musical term beat, which is what I would have sort of began with, I think, but that comes later with him, which referred to the rhythmic patterns of jazz, a genre that influenced many beatniks. I say it's a genre that was co-opted or adopted by the beatniks, right? Here, now, beatniks were often stereotyped as wearing black clothing, berets, I think I said that earlier, sunglasses and goatees, right? Not just goatee. I got a goatee. I don't have a beatnik goatee. Beatnik goatee, and it goes back to that Nick suffix, Soviet Jew thing, right? It is a Lenin goatee, right? It's a Lenin goatee. Look, I'm telling you, all of these things have everything to do with that suffix, right? It matters. It makes sense, right? So anyway, wearing black clothing, berets, sunglasses, and goatees, and speaking in hip slang, of course, that is, you don't know what hip slang is because the word hip is hip slang, right? Jesus, help us, please. Hip slang that incorporated words like cool, dig, groovy, and square. You didn't see it because this is audio, but I just like drew the Pulp Fiction square with my hands as I said that. You square cat daddy. They frequented coffee houses, bookstores, bars, and clubs where they listened to jazz, read poetry, discussed philosophy, and engaged in political activism, and probably sucked some dick in the bathroom and dumpster while they were at it. That did not appear on Wikipedia, by the way. That's just a little interjection on my behalf. And again, you are welcome to it. Some of the most famous beatnik venues were the Six Gallery in San Francisco, where Ginsberg read his read his poem Howl in 1955, which was rather gay from what I understand. Gaslight Cafe in New York City. You see the San Francisco, New York thing. I keep coming back to that, right? Because it's actual. It's historical. It's real, right? It's real. Anyway, I think that's enough of a picture of what a beatnik stereotype draws out to be. Now, I sum it up as simply, like I was starting to say before, through my own personal experience, they're just dropout losers. Dropout losers. They're people that just, for whatever reason, cannot get along with society as it is and works their imaginations into justifying leaving it and trying to start something different and apart, which in this case, and in every case really, ends up being a cancer. The idea is to get with it. If you can't get with it, get strong enough to get with it. People will help you out invariably. Speaking of helping people out, here's an idea. Here's an example, right, of what the founding moray of this beatnik counterculture is about. I mentioned four particular authors at the core of this social movement. One of them being a guy named Neil Cassady, right? Neil Cassady. I am not personally familiar with anything that Neil Cassady ever did. I read his name and it comes up a blank to me for some reason. The other guys, I've read or heard their stuff, you know? Not all of it, but some of it here and there. When I was a teenager, when I was a dropout, right? When I was counterculture. I did not get down with this whole beatnik thing, don't get me wrong. I didn't get to that degree of it, but I dabbled a little bit, right? A very little bit. This Neil Cassady guy, right? Summed up really short. He had a very tough upbringing. For one reason or another, he was fatherless. The father either abandoned him or died or some shit like that. He ended up in the streets as a young teen, right? As a young teen, he's out on the streets, and he was stealing to make his way. And he got popped a bunch of times, you know. He had a little rap sheet going in his teenage years. And somebody, some benevolent patron, comes along and sees something special in this boy. And decides he is going to support an education for this person, right? Get him into finishing school, getting him into college. And what a very kind act, right? A kind act. You get a kid down and out, and just some really good, nice person comes along and helps him to lift himself up off the gutter, elevate him into proper society, right? Ain't that great? Well, this wonderful patron turned out to be grooming this teenage boy to being his sexual possession, his little dirty young trophy, right? And poor young Mr. Cassady ends up being a street groomed faggot as a result, right? Well, not groomed in the street, but from the streets he became groomed into faggotry by this guy who was paying his bill. What do we call that? Sugar daddy. How many times have I told you about the gay culture in this country? The dirty secret about how it is very much about pedophilia, and you have this sugar daddy relationship that goes on. All these old faggots, they want to go in for the young ones, right? Now, the one who drove by with the catcall before, he was a young one. I'm an old dude, so everything was back ass words there, and it makes you wonder. It just makes you wonder. And, I don't want to wonder too much, but so you got this Neil Cassady guy who is, you know, hey, two things we get in life. We get a hand dealt and we get to play it, right? That's how life is. Neil Cassady had a bad hand and he played it the way he played it. He ends up being a drug addicted faggot writer, right? Now, he is one element of, he represents one element of the nature, of the character of this social movement, you know, where everybody's looking at the anti-materialism and all that fluff. The actual character, the actual true nature of the movement is in the core of the people it's built around. And person number one, you've got this drugs and faggotry, right? With Jack Kerouac, who I mentioned earlier, as the principal of it. He was the one who was not gay, but, as I mentioned before, he was schizoid and a raging alcoholic who died of physical complications from alcoholism in his mid-40s, right? He did not get to live a full life. He was basically a drunk writer who lived in his mother's attic or some shit like that and hung around in Greenwich Village with a bunch of queers and drug addicts. And he drank in the middle of it all, right? I guess he was like the older statesman, elder statesman of it. I don't know. William S. Burroughs, right? So now we've got this you know, drug addict, homosexual, alcoholic, schizoid / mental health issues. Now, William S. Burroughs, who was born into a very well-to-do situation. In fact, in the town where my cousins grew up, Warren, New Jersey, there was a facility, a business called Burroughs. A friend of mine, who's a friend of mine to this day, worked there. I think he tried to get me a job there one time. My brother's ex-wife worked there. Burroughs Corporation. It's the same Burroughs, right? William S. Burroughs and Burroughs Corporation. They are kinfolk, right? This guy was born into that fortune. So he was raised up like a prince. And somehow he became a heroin addict. And somehow he got into the magic and the occult, you know, like Aleister Crowley type. And somehow he ended up bisexual. Maybe he might have finished out his life as queer. You know, he started, had a wife and everything like that, and then lost his, if I remember correctly, lost his libido, and then when it returned, he started pursuing men. What it sounds like to me is he discovered his inner faggot and left heterosexuality behind. But there's that gayness again, right? That keeps coming up here, huh? So we're alcoholic, schizoid, heroin addict, occultist, magician, double faggot, drug addicts, and then the last one's Allen Ginsberg. And here's where you bring in the commie and the Jew. All right? So now we put all this together, and this is what the core nature, the interior qualities of this beatnik movement emanate from. Right, and I'll say it again. I mean, your what do you call it? Emblematic beatnik is at once a dropout, alcoholic, drug addict, schizoid, homosexual, communist Jew. Allen Ginsberg was not just a communist Jew, by the way. He was also a, drum roll please, faggot, right? This is the core of the counterculture in the United States of America. This is what started the ball rolling. Through the 60s, through the 70s and 80s and 90s, the 2000s, the 2010s, here now into the 2020s. All goes back to that. And guess what? The stink today is the same stink that it was all the way back then. The same qualities persevere. Interesting. To me, I don't know what you think. If you have commentary, you can email me at roundfile, one word, at post-arland.com, roundfile. Right, that's my email account where I don't give a shit, so I don't read it, right? So there you go. Now, if you know me and you're a friend of mine, you will know how to get in touch with me, right? So anyway, all that beatnik stuff, ends up being a bohemian world of addiction, homosexuality, occultism. Oh, I didn't mention Buddhism. All these guys were into Buddhism, right? All these guys were in a perpetual search for truth, for reason, for purpose. And strangely enough, with the combination of their homosexuality, drug and alcohol abuse, Buddhism, occultism, none of them found the answer. Not one of them died a Christian. Not one of them came to faith. Now, I speak about a little bit here and there in my experience as a dropout in life early on. As the years went by, I put everything about that one by one behind me. And when all the dust settled, I was a very much different person than any of these dropouts I just described, having none of those qualities whatsoever. I was free and clear to continue my pursuit of truth without any kind of anchors holding me down, without dragging any kind of stone behind me, without any kind of blinders on my eyes, and without any kind of influence in my brain skewing my thinking, negatively impacting my perception. I came to truth. These counterculture icons did not. I guess, as Bobby Bear would say, that makes me the winner.
This monologue is continued in the next episode, Chapter 00072, Taraxacology, Part 3.
Thank you for tuning into Post-Arlen Monologics. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Arlen Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at postarlen.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@postarlen.com.